Hello, Asymmetry. What's going on, everybody? Super excited to join Ira and Darlene, two of Mirai's very valued students, and a couple extremely unique in their approach to bonsai based on their location in North America. Ira and Darlene exist in Las Vegas, Nevada, one of the most challenging environments to cultivate bonsai in, and they have been at the forefront of a large experiment in what it means to do bonsai in the desert, informing my knowledge as an instructor and trying out so many of the different pieces of knowledge and technique. Ira's family has a history in bonsai. Darlene's family has a fascinating story, and Ira and Darlene were very kind to share their background and some of the information and experiences growing bonsai in the desert. This is a fun one, lighthearted and short for you guys. Sit back, enjoy, and cherish the moment with Ira and Darlene in studio.
I used to read the newspaper for the blind onto the radio every Saturday morning. So it was me and another volunteer every Saturday we'd read. So that was close as I ever got. But it was kind of fun because it was a real like radio station.
Yeah.
And then they would produce, not really produce it because it was live.
Yeah.
So, but we used to have, there was this one story, local story up in Seattle about this, the life of this little girl who was going through a bad, I can't remember if she had leukemia or something like that, right? And we were reading this story and you could hear your voice catch as it was the end.
Yeah.
And there was radio silence as we're both trying to, you know, get ourselves together. And it was like, and then hold your breath and then right back into it.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It was probably the toughest thing
I
ever did.
I bet.
When I was there, it was, but it was a good gig. It was sad when they lost their funding and they couldn't do it anymore.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was sad when she died. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
That is sad. It was very sad.
That was very sad.
I hate it when that happens.
Life and death, man.
Yeah,
life
and death. Right.
Ties into the uniform.
We are in uniform today. We gotta get a photo of this.
Yeah, definitely.
This is awesome.
What do you believe in?
Yeah, life and death.
Ryan started a cult here at Mirai.
That's right. Everybody's drinking the coffee.
Yeah, does taste a little different.
At Mirai, it's the coffee, not the Kool-Aid. Yeah. And the clumpy milk.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's like he's got to double check those dates.
I can't do the clumpy milk.
Oh, couldn't hang.
Yeah. Right. I always find it interesting when people are obsessed with the dates.
We talked about that a little bit downstairs, too.
I think it says something about the person.
Like staying within the lines or something?
Oh, I don't know what it says. I just think it says something.
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
I'm just like, how does this reflect poorly on me? Ryan's opinion always means so much. What am I supposed to say here?
Do I need to stop looking at the dates?
Wait a second.
No.
What would Ryan do?
Jonathan Cross, the first night that he got here, I was going to cook up steaks, and I had some steaks in the fridge that had been there for a week. And I pulled him out and I'm like, hey man, you think these are still good? And he's like, how long they been in there? I was like, yeah, probably like a week. And he was like, no.
Really?
He's like 3, maybe 4 days.
Yeah.
But once you hit the 7 day mark, I wouldn't do it. So we opened him up and smelled him. And I was like, they smell pretty good. They smell all right. And he's like, I won't be eating those.
Yeah.
So
I would have eaten it with
you. Don't they age this stuff for like 60
days? That's what I'm saying.
Like, isn't that part of the process?
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
Like in a,
aren't you going to cook it?
That's exactly it too. I was like, it's going to go. But he's like, well, you would have to cook it to be well done in order for it to be safe.
And that would just ruin everything.
Wait, but I just made a point. They do age steak.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
And they dry age it or wet age it.
Here's the difference. They age it as a massive carcass of meat, and then they shave off all of the exterior and then cut it up. So once you get the cut up portion, it's no longer applicable as to how it's aged. Right now it just goes bad. It's not encased in the
I just learned about aging meat a little bit.
Yeah,
a little bit closer.
Yeah, they have gotten to the point where they can age meat for like, I want to say over a year.
Oh.
I don't
think I've heard about that with sausages. Don't they like make sausage? Someone who used to work at a restaurant in Denver, a friend of mine, and they would make sausages and they had a special cooler that it would age for like 3 months or 4 months, six, all these different ages. And it was more and more expensive the longer they aged the sausage. He told me that the longer you let that age, the better the taste, the flavor. So that's why it's so expensive.
Yeah. Well, with beef, it breaks down the tendons and the connective tissue. Oh, so it becomes more that's tender, right?
Yep. Yeah, I think that's part of that.
Less gamey.
There was there's a steakhouse in Minneapolis.
What was the cow's name? Where did the cow grow up?
Right. Right. What was his living conditions?
Can we look at his actual like pasture and observe?
Does he have any friends that are still there that we could talk to about this?
Corroborate some of your story?
Yeah, exactly. I just want to see how they're doing. How did they handle his departure?
Was he content?
Was he content? That's right. Yeah. Did he get to gallop? Frolic?
Was he a frolicking cow?
Yeah, exactly.
I've seen cows. They don't frolic.
Actually, yeah, you're born and raised in Edmonton, Alberta. Like, people don't realize that's big cowboy,
cow country.
Is
up
it
there.
Really?
Okay, I didn't know this.
I had no idea either. Yeah.
Alberta beef, man.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know.
Beef and oil. That's what we do.
Yeah.
Beef, oil, and wheat.
Oh, there you go. Wheat.
Yeah. Wheat. Yeah. Huh. Look, my brain is wrinkling as we speak.
It's an interesting town to visit because it's kind of in the middle of nowhere there, and the provincial governments, the kind of the legislature areas, really beautiful and old English.
Edmonton
feels very European architecture. It's a neat town.
How big is Edmonton?
You mean population-wise or size?
Just like a rough like size to a comparable city in the United States.
It's smaller than Portland.
Like 700,000 maybe or something?
Maybe like a Santa Barbara-ish kind of size?
Well, I've never been to Santa Barbara, but like a little over a million maybe.
Okay. All right.
They got the Edmonton Oilers.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Gretzky, baby.
Pride and joy.
That's right.
Pride and
my
joy.
Wayne Gretzky right there.
Pride and joy.
Hey. Yeah. The great thing about that is her mom worked at the university hospital in the nursery. So all the hockey players would like go there with their wives, and that's where the kids were all pretty much born. Yeah.
Anytime anybody had a baby, my mom would call and go, Yari Curry's in the nursery. Come on down. So I've met all of the Oilers.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Mark Messier, Yari Curry. I mean, when you're raised in Canada, you live and breathe hockey.
Mm.
And I had a little brother who was little, they call them mini mites when they're 5 or 6.
Is this a Canadian term?
Mini mites. Yeah.
It's like the name of the hockey league or something.
Yeah.
Like Pee Wee baseball or something, right?
Yeah. All right.
So you're driving to rural towns in the middle of the winter, sitting on these metal benches, watching these little kids in an unheated arena, watching them not skate very well. But then, my 1 year of my little brother not skating, and he's like, that's it. I'm icing in the backyard, and my little brother would learn how to skate in the back of the yard. So we had a skating rink in our backyard.
Well, they just flooded your backyard and let it freeze?
Yeah,
that's
her dad
what you
did
do. This.
But
that's what everybody does?
Yeah, that's a common thing in Canada, I thought.
Yeah.
That's how they get so good at freaking hockey, those bastards.
Part of that is because that's what Walter Gretzky did
there
for
you
Wayne.
Go. That's the big
that's
connection.
That's the story.
That is
Wayne's dad did that, and then all of a sudden everybody did that.
Oh, I thought they did it because everyone already did that.
No, that's Walter. Walter all the way.
Well, it's good to follow Wayne Gretzky anyways. I'll do what he does. I used to tuck my shirt in the side like him and thought it was so cool.
He's a G, man.
You are from Michigan, and that is hockey country as well.
It is hockey country, yeah.
Oh,
Gordie Howe, that was a Wayne Gretzky's idol.
I'm going to say the great one, best name ever.
Oh.
Oh.
Strong to very strong.
Strong to very strong. literally, if you had to pick
a name,
I want that one, the great one. So Darlene, you grew up in Edmonton.
I did.
But you've lived a lot of places. Or not so much. Did you go from Edmonton to Washington?
I went from Edmonton to Washington and then Washington to Nevada. So not so many places. Uh-huh. I have traveled because both my parents are Filipinos. So we would go as, I mean, I think I was 10 or 11 when we took our first trip to the Philippines.
Yeah.
And you can't just go to the Philippines. You have to go to Japan or Indonesia or wherever the pit stop is.
Oh, in terms of the
layover.
Flight. Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I lived in Edmonton for a long time. It was really all I knew.
Uh-huh.
And I really had, it was, you know, when you don't know anything, it really is the best. It's, I mean, I love my hometown, right?
Yeah.
I love my hometown. And growing up with hockey and you know, I had up until last year, my best friend I knew since I was 5 years old. I mean, not many people can say that.
Yeah.
And it was a great place to grow up.
That's awesome.
You know, I remember one thing you said, or maybe it was you who said that some of your earliest memories have something to do with trees.
Yeah.
And I think
you've said that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember growing up as a kid, we lived on the edge of town and there was this clump of, I don't know what it is, undeveloped forest area with a kind of a creek running through it. And those were the days when you just let your kids go and just say, be home for dinner, right? Mm-hmm. And so we'd always just be out in the middle of the forest, just hanging out, you know, doing whatever. And you didn't really worry about anything.
Yeah.
I feel like it's so hard for kids these days.
I know, right?
And they have so much more to worry about than I ever did. I mean, I remember I was just being a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Just be, do whatever you want. You didn't have to worry about anything. So yeah, it was a great place to grow up.
And then how did your parents end up in Edmonton?
Mm.
Both of your parents are Filipino, yeah. And they're like
similar climate. They really love the snow growing up in the
Philippines to Edmonton. I mean, it just makes like, sense. Like, yeah.
I saw a postcard. I was misled. It was a summer day.
Oh, that's a story I grew up hearing on a regular basis. So, it's in the Philippines. This sort of the way it works is you have a lot of kids. And then you hope that some of those kids end up working where they can send money back to the family, mm-hmm. to help raise the rest of the kids. And then as a whole, the family does better. So because my mom was the fourth of 10, she had to wait for her shot to go to school.
Mm.
And when the first boy made it through college, it was then her turn. The first two didn't go. So she went, and her best shot at leaving the country, which was always her goal, was to be a nurse, because at that time, Canada didn't have enough nurses.
Hmm.
So she said, okay, if I know I'm going to get a job abroad being a nurse, then that's what I'm going to do. So she went to school. Of course, she's behind because she had to wait. But she had met my dad while she was going to school. And they were going to cut her off from school because they said, if you get married, you're not going to finish school. You're going to end up pregnant. And then you're not going to be making money and sending to the family, right?
Yeah.
So we'll send the next person to school. And she said, nope. She said, I'm going to finish, which she did. And she got that job she had an uncle in rural Alberta. And he, back then, all you needed was one relative, no matter how distant, to say, yeah, when she gets here, I'll make sure that she has a place to live. And she had a job already. So she left, and she had eloped before she left with my dad. And she was pregnant with me.
Wow.
And she landed in rural Alberta in the middle of winter.
From the Philippines.
From the Philippines.
Pregnant.
Pregnant without her husband. She had a job.
Did she have a coat?
No. No, she had nothing.
Nice detail, right?
That is a detail there, because that is a huge change.
Yeah, she had nothing. She got dropped off at a bus stop in the middle of Alberta. And I'm like, I can't even imagine. I mean, my mom is a strong woman to have gone through that. And I owe everything that I am today for the fact that she took that leap. I mean, we had just traveling from Washington, Nevada is tough these days. And she hopped on a plane. She always says, what was it? It was a fly now, pay later flight back then, which was, it was like, what does that mean? Is that like you paid your airfare on layaway?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, pump your gas first. We'll trust you to pay for it. They don't even do that anymore here, right?
No.
You got to pay first before you can get a tank of gas.
Fly now, pay later.
Yeah.
I wonder if people were still smoking on the airplane at that time.
Oh, I'm sure.
I think they were.
I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Just carbon.
They had a non-smoking section, though, so it was no big deal.
Yeah, right.
Inside of
with a little curtain. A little curtain that divides the two.
Totally separate airspace.
Yeah, exactly. You're good. Let's turn up the airflow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, your mom's pretty special. She worked nights so that she'd be home for the kids. She's like kind of sleep-deprived adulthood, just being there for you and your brother. And
yeah, she did that for a year because I didn't meet my dad till I was one. And
he was still in the Philippines?
Mm-hmm. And waiting to get sponsored by my mom.
Oh.
So it was chain migration.
Chain migration. Gosh. And we'll just leave that right there.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. She always tells me, she said, because you know, you meet friends and you meet people while you're working. And she said, you never, never let any man pick you up without bawling. She said, anybody else could pick you up, any female, any one of my female friends, but not one guy did you let get near you until your dad showed up. Which I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if she remembers that correctly, but I kind of feel like maybe even as a kid, you kind of know who your dad is.
Yeah.
You know?
It's kind of a sweet story.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
Woo!
Crazy.
Yeah.
Either that or like till the stork shows up and you're like, I remember that stork. That was the guy who dropped me off.
Little black tips on his feather.
Yeah. His name was Bill.
And then, so from Washington to Las Vegas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a big transition.
Mm-hmm.
From the temperate rainforest to the desert.
The desert.
Vegas, baby.
Vegas. Vegas!
Vegas!
3 days a year that rain and it's like a torrential light. It's a flash flood. Everything floods in the city.
That's when you go out collecting. And you're like, there is moss here. And then like the next time you go out, like, oh, where did it go?
It's gone.
I told you we should have collected it all last weekend.
I was shocked. I was shocked when I drove to Vegas the day after Christmas, seeing snow on the mountains around Las Vegas. I was just like, where am I? What is this?
It snowed at our house this last year.
In Las Vegas.
In Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. We live in Henderson now, which is like on the southeast part of the valley there, but it snowed in our house, or at our house, rather.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was wild.
We don't have a roof, so yeah, it's snowed in our house.
Exactly. It snowed in our house. Vegas. Yeah. It's complicated.
Yeah, it snowed at our house while we were here.
Yeah.
We were here.
Yeah, and that's true. We were up here for our February class.
That was when we were driving back...
Oh my gosh.
The U-Haul truck from your grandpa's.
We flew up. I got the call that my grandfather, who's 96, was finally going to move out of his place in Bellevue there, right next to Seattle. And it's like, well, they're going to sell the house, or he's going to sell the house. If you want any furniture or personal items or anything, like, now's kind of like the chance to get it. And I was like in a little bit of a panic because I love my grandfather, and there's so many pieces at his place that he had made or his dad had made. So I was interested in trying to get some of those if I could.
Wait, your grandfather's father?
Yeah, my great-grandfather. He used to build houses and was like a good carpenter. And then him, he had other jobs too, but he was just part of that generation of people, I think, where they just made a lot of their own things, maybe because of cost or something. I'm not sure, but very handy. My grandpa's very, very handy too. But so we flew up to go get some things from his house.
Did you guys meet in Washington?
We met in Seattle.
Yeah. Did you grow up in Washington?
I was born in Spokane and then never really lived there very long. And then I lived in Seattle. Actually, we stayed with my grandparents for a little while when I was a kid. Lived in Portland. I went to kindergarten and first grade in Portland. And then I actually grew up in Crescent City, California, on the north coast there. Kind of a really neat area to grow up, but kind of not a lot of opportunity economically. So maybe not the best place to be after you kind of get out of school. But and then I had moved to Las Vegas once when I was 21 and a half or something like that. I used to be a table games dealer and dealt poker and stuff. Started doing that when I was 19. Then lived in Vegas for a few months and wasn't really enjoying it. Didn't know, I moved down there not knowing anybody. And then made a friend there who was from Seattle and had a lot of ties to Seattle. So I moved back up to Seattle and then lived there for 12 years. And somewhere in there, Darlene and I met. We met ballroom dancing. Got to get that in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's key because it makes you seem like a real sweet person when you say that.
Did you work in the fishing industry in Crescent City? Because there's fishing boats that go out of there, right?
I didn't, but I had several of my high school friends worked on like crab boats and like fishing boats and stuff.
I've gotten some canned tuna from there, and they just take this beautiful chunk and they put it in there, and it's the best tuna I've ever had.
You can go down to the harbor and like buy fish right from the fishermen there.
Yeah,
and there's a couple restaurants that are right down there. It's a really neat area. It's a little tourist trappy kind of place on Highway 101.
Until they get me.
Yeah, totally. They used to have like a really good logging industry in that area too.
Not anymore.
Yeah. And so when we moved there, it was 1985 and there was one stoplight in town. Or maybe they were just putting in the first stoplight. And there were like six mills in the surrounding area. And by the time I was at a high school, there were like zero that were functional.
All gone.
So that was kind of a weird time for Northern California where they were just really transitioning out of that industry.
Yeah.
And economically, it's kind of a little bit of a depressed area. And then they built a big prison there when I was in middle school, Pelican Bay State Prison. So that's one of the big employers there now. But
the communities that were created around the timber industry have all really suffered, whether it was actual logging or whether it was the milling of the lumber. I mean, that's the story of St. Helens.
I know we were talking about that driving around the other day.
That's the story of the Pacific Northwest in general, and Northern California. Maybe even prior to the Pacific Northwest, sort of
feeling that crunch.
Yeah, and I mean it's a resource that was abundant when it hadn't been touched, and then you start touching it and the impact of it, and you know we learn as humans, obviously, and it or try to, and seeing the community of St. Helens. When I first moved here, there was a sign as you drove into town that said like America's number one small town or something. And it was 1986 was the date on it. And it was hanging by two chains, but one of the chains had broken.
Oh boy.
So it was just hanging crooked for like 2 years after I first moved here. It was just like hanging. The paint was like flaking off of it and stuff. And it was such a, I wish I'd taken a picture of it because it was such a, reminder,
like a metaphor.
It was very
whole,
metaphorical. Yeah, like this like, place used to be this great town and the mill supported it. And if you talk to a lot of the people that grew up here or lived here, like Main Street headed down towards the river. I guess it was impossible to get a business space in those buildings along that main drag. And it was like a booming, you know, hustling, bustling little place. And Highway 30 used to go right through the downtown.
Oh, it looped through that area?
Yeah, so there was no bypass through the upper portion of town. And it was just like this hot spot, St. Helens, Oregon. And man alive, did that come crashing down.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful to see it kind of revitalizing.
Yeah, we went down there and had lunch the other day. I mean, it's a cool area.
It's really
the
view, cool.
The views, I mean, it's a beautiful like setting, and I can see why people would have loved spending time there just outside of everything else.
Randy told me that this was the deep port. This is the port here is deeper than the one in Portland.
Okay, so the bigger ships could come in.
Yeah, bigger ships could come in here for a while. And then what happened was land just was so much cheaper down there that they transitioned, because St. Helens was a booming community and it was expensive. So that's what ended up making Portland happen, was because St. Helens got too big. Or, I don't know about too big.
Too expensive.
There's the word, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
One of the factors, I'm sure, right?
Oh, that's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Randy let me know, because I was asking, the house he was in was built in 1855, the one that he was renting last.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh my gosh.
Local historian, Randy Knight.
There you go.
he runs the museum downtown.
Born and raised.
Yeah. Make sure you go visit him when you're in
town. Was Randy born here?
Yeah, born and raised right here. Yeah. It's weird. You go to the...
I don't think it's that one. It's the sun.
If you go down to like some of the stores and stuff, I've gone to the store with Randy, and some of the ladies are like, "Oh, you know Randy?" I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "I used to go to high school with him in middle school," and I just want to go, "Oh, really?"
It is a really. We're 27 miles from Portland, and the change in culture
is huge.
27 miles from Portland boggles my mind.
Yeah, you go through the time warp just outside of Scappoose. Yeah, whatever.
Things change.
I think once you go past Linton, you're basically in a different
official
planet.
Yeah, it's official.
Yeah. And Portland has no urban sprawl as a city. That's what's pretty fascinating to observe about it. It is
interesting. Yeah.
You leave the city limits of Portland, and it's like city, forest.
Yeah, they shut the gates behind you as you leave.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They wrote a law in the city of Portland that there wasn't allowed any urban sprawl, and they wouldn't let anything spread. And that's also what brought the land cost up, and why we're having this boom right now is they had to go back and change the laws to increase occupancy per lot or whatever. I don't know what there's a term for it or something.
Yeah.
So they just changed
those
that law.
Rules or whatever. Yeah. So that's a Southern California situation too, where they're changing some of that, I think.
Yeah, now they're encouraging the building of ADUs and stuff like that, because they need places for people to live.
You're getting tax breaks if you build them and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. What's it like? So, you know, talking with you guys, Las Vegas and the desert of the Western United States is, for some people, it's like a great escape, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I was in college, I went to the Black Rock Desert. Not for Burning Man, but where Burning Man takes place. I just went when Burning Man wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. And you get out into the desert and you find, to a large degree, a population of people that are existing outside of the eye of society in the middle of the desert.
A lot of them are St. Helens transplants.
it's a totally different appeal, the desert is. And obviously, like, Las Vegas is a little different in terms of being out there. But why did you guys move to Las Vegas, and what is the appeal of the desert, and do you like it?
Yeah, that's interesting. Part of it, so it was 2012, and that was kind of the bottom of the housing market down there. And we were living in Seattle, and I think part of it was we were looking for a fresh start and just kind of to go somewhere else where you know, people just knew us as kind of, we both have previous relationships, so we were kind of interested in a fresh start, I think. And then also the weather. At that time, I was working in special inspections and construction management for a company that did a lot of projects with Microsoft and Boeing and Amazon and some other. I was doing structural inspections, basically, but I was outside every single day. So after about 5 years of that.
Rain or shine.
Yeah. Every day. Yeah. So like, I mean, you look like a fisherman on a boat. I mean, you're wearing Grundins or your Carhartt, you know, waterproof gear. And, anyway, it's just kind of fatigue from that, and just the weather, I guess, was kind of getting the best of me. And then the pricing for Las Vegas was just great. And the weather's good there. I mean, obviously the summer can be quite hot, but you can either hide from the heat for a few months, or you could try to hide from the rain in Seattle for, you know, 6 months, I guess, was kind of one of the arguments there.
Or embrace the rain.
Or embrace it and just stand outside in it for 9 or 10 hours a day and just enjoy that. Grow web feet.
And it wasn't our first choice. We looked at
Southern California a little bit too, and Arizona.
Why to the dry desert though? Why even look at Arizona? Why look at Nevada? I mean, Southern California, I get it, but even that's just really dry. And so you were trying to get out of the gray, wet gloom.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. Wanted to see the sun again. Yeah, that was a big part of it.
We were reaching for sun, and we figured if we can't afford to live in California, we can't afford to buy a house in California. Mm-hmm. Then we could either buy a house in Arizona or Nevada. But who's going to go visit you in Arizona?
Yeah, that was a big
part
of it.
If you live in Las Vegas, all planes fly to Vegas.
Yeah.
All roads lead to Vegas.
Yeah. And I tell you that,
go to Rome. And
no one came to visit us in Seattle.
Yeah, none of my, that's actually interesting. None of my high school buddies like ever came up there.
But we have a revolving door.
Revolving door, yeah.
In our place now, everyone comes to visit us eventually.
And it's not just the resort lifestyle or the casinos. I mean, like some of my buddies will just go on like on a cool golfing trip, or there's like interesting landscapes to hike and Red Rock Canyon and Mount Charleston, and you can get to Grand. You can do a day trip to Grand Canyon. You can do a day trip to Zion National Park in southern Utah.
Hoover Dam's
right there.
It's
beautiful.
We never go to the Strip.
Yeah, we're not really living that lifestyle. But it's cool that it's there if you want to do something, if you want to go see a show, if you want to have an amazing meal. There's a lot of great restaurants in town. There's just a lot of appeal other than what I think people judge that area on. Mm-hmm. And I know Darlene's line that I thought was really kind of appropriate is people that kind of just think it's all just gambling and that's the whole lifestyle. And I worked in the industry for 12 years in total, in between table games and poker, as a dealer and also a pit boss, and helped run a poker room and kind of through my travels in that industry. But Darlene had said, how would you feel if someone judged your town based on one street? And that's kind of how people look at Las Vegas. They're just like, oh, the Strip, it sucks, it just did whatever. And I mean, there are some parts of it that can be kind of abrasive, and maybe, and you see a lot of people that are just intoxicated and carrying on, and maybe that's not what you want to do, and you don't have to do that. But there's also just beautiful things to do in the desert. We weren't really aware of all those things. We were kind of moving there for some other reasons, but it's just been a nice kind of exploration of our own backyard and enjoying that kind of stuff. And even like finding places to go collecting the last couple of years through, you know, our experiences here and talking to you about that and some of the other Mariah students. But it's great. We love it down there. We love to kind of represent that community, especially with Bonsai, because it's just so random. You know, people tell you, like, you do what? Like, what Bonsai? Like, how does that work? Are they all inside, or how does that?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, they're all outside. You know, we've got shade cloth, and, you know, and you've got shade cloth here in the summer, too. It's not like it's completely a foreign principle, but, yeah, we love it. We love it down there.
I think for people that have never experienced the outdoor aspects of Las Vegas, have no concept how environmentally diverse of an area it is, because you're down in the valley floor in Las Vegas, but you have how tall is Mount Charleston and the peaks that are around Las Vegas?
I want to say it's like 10,000 feet. Yeah, something
I mean,
like that.
I think that's you're getting up into alpine territory.
And yeah, there's Bristol. When you go up to Mount Charleston, there's like there's a South Loop Trail and North Loop Trail. And I believe it's the North Loop Trail. You'll see bristlecone pines there. And it's part of that same range that extends over into Bishop and the White Mountains in California. Uh-huh. And there's ponderosas up there. I mean, it's wild.
How far out of Vegas is that?
You can, it's probably like 40 minutes, 45 minutes.
See, people just don't understand that. 45 minutes out of the desert and you're in a bristlecone pine forest.
There's a little ski resort up there too. There's like a 3-chair ski resort. You can ski and play golf in the same day, which is kind of a odd thing.
Yeah.
But there's like places that do like little tournaments like that. We'll go ski in the morning and come back in the afternoon and play 18 holes or something. But It's very unique. It's a unique area.
And it's becoming an outdoor mecca. I mean, there's a lot of
rock climbing.
Yeah, rock climbing.
Huge there.
Alex Honnold, like the
totally
the most famous rock climber in the world, chose to live in Vegas. You know, whereas everybody thinks California, yeah. or I mean, there's a lot of rock climbing regions across the country, but
yeah,
there is a huge outdoor adventure sport population that focuses there because you've got pretty much everything.
Yeah, the bartender at our in our community, there's a restaurant. And one of the bartenders there, he goes rock climbing like all the time. He's like, oh yeah, I see Alex up there all the time and talk to him. You know, I was just like, so, and I had never heard that, but mm-hmm. I was like, I knew I had heard of Alex, you know, yeah. but I was like, that seems so random, but yeah, that's what's happening.
Yeah. Las Vegas. And again, like the appeal to the desert is something that growing up in the Rockies and then going to school on the coast of California, the desert, I was always in very close proximity to the desert growing up because I lived on the western slope of the Rockies where the Utah desert runs into the foothills of the mm-hmm. Rockies. And we used to drive to Arizona for spring break to see my mom's side of the family mm-hmm. and watch spring training baseball games
and
hang out, yeah. you know, but that drive between the mountains and Arizona for five to 15 years old when we sort of a 10-year stretch of solid spring breaks in Arizona, the desert to me was just a long, boring road.
Mm-hmm.
And as a kid, it was hot. The sun was like beating you to death in the like old cars, no tinted windows, air conditioning barely worked. It was like the most miserable experience of my life. And that's what my association with the desert was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really taken until this point in my life to go to the desert now and recognize this is pretty outstanding. Yeah. It's a pretty stunning landscape that the Western deserts of North America provide, the geology and the diversity and the really unique habitat and mm-hmm. flora that exists there is fascinating.
Yeah, it is interesting. You're totally right. There's a place that we've gone several times. It's called the Springs Preserve. And that's how kind of that town started. So there was all the aquifers that were building up water and pressure finally had to release that. And the water was working its way through the fissures of the substrate. And the place that it came up was where the Springs Preserve currently exists. So that's kind of what started that community. It was just the water source that was there. And then as more and more people moved there in the early 20th century into the mid 20th century, people tapping into the aquifers and putting wells in the ground slowly took the pressure away from that. And then the springs doesn't really bubble up there anymore, but they have a neat museum there and just kind of talk about the history of the valley and show all the exhibits and talk about, just like the plant life and stuff. It's really interesting how that all kind of works and not really like you, not really ever knowing about that growing up. I mean, I grew up near the Redwoods in Northern California and you tend to kind of, that's your, I guess your baseline of what you enjoy or are used to or familiar with. And the desert for me, it was always kind of like that too. I remember long road trips with my parents and just being like, oh, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And this whole stretch, like it's just barren. But you actually can see a lot of beauty in the like the cactus and succulents there and some of the Joshua trees. And
mm-hmm.
then just like we talked about, there's the mountain ranges nearby where there's Utah junipers and pinyon pines and ponderosa pines and bristle cones. And you're just like, wow, this is all kind of in and around us. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it is. I think it is just that. When you think about that orientation of comfort being surrounded by trees and vegetation, if that's your reference to what is normal mm-hmm. or what you accept to be, this is home or this is sure. what I understand the world to be, just like Edmonton, you're talking about like that was my version of home.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you're in this place that's stripped of all of that. And this is where I think trees do have such a significant, formidable impact on our concept of what the world is. If you grow up around them and all of a sudden they're gone, it's a game changer. It mm-hmm. really is. There's like a loss of comfort. There's a loss of that association in the desert. But it seems almost like a point of maturation as you get really sort of aware of more and more landscapes and can appreciate the nuances of it. Yeah. I'm totally captivated by the desert now. And what you guys are doing in Las Vegas with Bonesai is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to go pretty hard. We're trying to represent Mariah. So when you're doing that, you can't go halfway, right?
Yeah, we don't play that soft game.
It's like, how many trees do you have? It's like, well, it's getting close to 100, but there's two of us, so it's still like less than 50 each. You know?
Right. We're still well within the realm of reasonable. What does it take to grow bonsai in Las Vegas, Nevada? Well, first of all, Ira, your grandfather grew bonsai, or your
great.
It's my great grandparents on my dad's side. So my great grandfather and great grandmother, both in the Sacramento area, were growing bonsai. And my great grandfather also went collecting in the kind of the northeastern part of the state and stuff. But that was
back when? Is this pre World War II?
No. And you know what's weird is like we had this conversation with Aaron Packard because my grandfather and Darlene and I had gone there to visit PBM. And that's what he was trying to establish. And my grandfather was like pretty certain that he's like, it would have had to have been pre-World War II because he was basing it on where they lived. But the best we've been able to document it was more like in the 50s and then maybe into the early 60s. But he just was exposed to bonsai at a Sacramento fair, like a state fair, and then just kind of caught the bug. And then he and my great-grandmother were both into bonsai, and they built a collection up to about 300 or 400 trees at one point.
Wow.
And it's kind of cool because I've got some old like little medals and things he has from like Sacramento Bonsai Society and the American Bonsai Association.
Kind of cool. That's freaking
super
awesome.
Cool. Yeah, it's super cool. Cool. Yeah.
Do you have any photographs or any?
Yeah,
you
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
Oh man,
I've got like a couple cool ones of my great grandfather, and he's got like an old like 35mm camera around his neck, and he's like standing next to his trees on a display at a show. It's just awesome, you know.
But there's I love the one of your great grandma where she's holding the little shoheen.
Oh yeah,
and
it looks like it's a little boxwood or something, and leaves, and she's just holding it, you know.
But they had interviewed her for the local newspaper.
Yeah, the Sacramento Bee. Yeah, Packard was like, he's like, you got to get into the archives and try to find more stuff. So we've like been online in the archives, but they don't go back far enough. So I think you have to go like, you know.
I think we have to actually physically go to the Sacramento Library and hit the microfiche.
But
it would be worth it.
I know.
I mean, if you just want to like go to Sacramento to library hunt,
yeah,
you know, like probably got other things going on.
And with that timeline, like we've become acquainted with Diane Winters, who's one of John Naka's grandkids, and she lives near. Like we go over to the Huntington and spend time over there and volunteer with Ted, and trying to get pretty involved in that community as well. But she was like, my grandpa and your great-grandpa, they had to have known each other. Like, you know, so we were like going through all these photo albums of John Naka's, trying to like find pictures, you know, just like these different events in California. And it was kind of a fun treasure hunt, but it was just like one evening. But yeah, it's kind of neat. And then when they passed away, my great-grandparents, the trees basically got split up between my grandfather and his two twin sisters. So for me growing up and spending, not unlike you, the spring break or the summers on your family vacation, he had 100, 150 trees in his backyard. My grandfather did. And as a kid, you know, I thought it was cool and appreciated it, but wasn't super, super into it at all. And even as like a young adult, when my grandmother, she had passed away probably about 18 years ago now, and my grandfather was living in this big house, and he's like, hey, do you want to come live here? And I was like, sure. And we've also just become great friends beyond just being, you know, related. But I was helping him, you know, overwinter his trees, and he'd dig up the dahlia garden that he had, his little vegetable garden. We bury all his trees in the ground in the winter and dig them back out and help him do his repotting and stuff. And was pretty involved trying to help him maintain his collection. But as he got older, he was kind of paring that down, giving them away to friends. And he got down to probably, I don't know, 30 to 50 of his favorite trees. And a lot of those were ones that were his dad's like favorite trees.
Whoa.
So those had been bonsai since,
you know, 50 years or something in a container, probably. And then the big catalyst for me, and then subsequently Darlene as well, kind of getting more into bonsai was us moving to Las Vegas. We had planned to stop in Portland, visit some family here, and then go to Reno and drive down to Vegas the rest of the way and meet our belongings at the house. But I called my grandpa and had him on the speakerphone or whatever in the car, and was talking to him, and just said, "Well, hey, we're heading out. Just wanted to call and check in, and we'll talk to you soon." And, you know, just kind of saying goodbye to him. And he says, "Well, I'm out of the business." And I was like, what does that mean? And he's like, "Yeah, I sold all the last of my trees."
Oh.
And I was like, "What?" Because I was interested, and he knew I was interested, but he had, so his son is my dad, obviously, and he's got a brother. So when he had made that decision, he'd taken like kind of a bad fall in the yard trying to maintain them or move them or something. And, he just decided, I can't manage these anymore. So he called my uncle and my dad, "Hey, would you like to have these trees?" And one lives in California, and that's my dad. He wasn't like super interested. And my uncle that, lived in the East Coast was just like, maybe it was too far or what it was, but, they both kind of passed. So he called up Bonsai Northwest. They're in Tukwila.
Mm-hmm.
And they drove out and basically bought all the trees from my grandpa and took the last of his collection. So he was explaining some of that to me on the phone, and we were supposed to go meet Darlene's girlfriends downtown and have like a little happy hour thing, which you always have to do that right before you go on a road trip, go have a couple cocktails.
Of course, yes, yeah, the way you kick off a big drive.
As I'm starting to say that, I was like, this doesn't sound right, but that's how it was actually. So instead of like participating in happy hour, I dropped her off and like blitzed down to Bonsai Northwest. I had never been there before. Like, uh-huh. I had been around Bonsai, but wasn't super into it. And then I went and actually bought some of my grandpa's trees and talked to the lady there. I think her name is Sharon.
Sharon.
Yeah.
Ruth, yeah.
Yeah. And she was super cool. And she's like, "Oh, yeah." So she just basically sold them to me for what she paid for them. She's like, "I don't need to make any money off it, but I'd like to get my money back." And I said, "That's cool." So we're moving to Las Vegas, and I don't have, you know, I've grown bonsai, and I'm kind of explaining this to her, and she's trying to give me a couple trees that are going to have a better chance of survival. And they weren't in any kind of soil like we would use, sure, through Marai. I mean, it was just my grandpa basically putting gravel, sand, and topsoil. That was his like repot mix that his dad used. So yeah, it wasn't like any extra thought. So we had I believe it was like a Sergeant Juniper that was kind of like a tanuki kind of style, because it was one that he had wrapped around his father's tree when it had passed away, when that tree passed. And then a little Siberian elm forest. And then something else. I can't remember the other one now. Maybe it was another Siberian elm. But so we took those trees with us to Vegas and just like loved them to death, you know, just like, well, it's hot outside. Cause it was like, was it July or August when we got down there?
It was August, and it was probably the hottest summer since we've moved there.
It was brutal.
And the trees were just like, what?
Totally.
Are you doing?
Oh man, it was nuts. So we like, we're like, oh, we'll get these humidity trays and try to build, you know, like we were just doing everything we could and like misting them like crazy and watering them, basically just like watered them to death, just mm-hmm. not giving them a chance to even dry out at all. So through that experience, as kind of painful as it was to, you know, acquire some trees that belonged to your grandfather and belonged to your great grandfather and watch those all perish due to your own kind of lack of experience and knowledge to manage them, that's what really drove us to find the Las Vegas Bonsai Society and become members there. And it, you know, our whole transition to caring for trees in Vegas was basically learning how to just keep things alive.
Yeah.
And that was like the first kind of hurdle to jump. And we have no issue with that now, but at the time when you don't really know anything, that's kind of what you're learning. And then it's like, how much work can you do? And then just kind of progressing from there. But that's what really gave us the bug, was just that experience. And then I'm the current president, but the former president had emailed me or everybody a link, and it was a feature on you walking through, I think it was like a Nat Geo mm-hmm. short or something like that. And he's like, oh yeah, this guy's like the next John Naka or whatever. So, you know, Bob Kovac's like, he's like the longtime president. And that club in Vegas started in 1990, which is just nuts. One of the original members still comes to our meetings sometimes, his old Japanese man named Wayne.
He used to tell us their first meetings were in the back of a Denny's, the back room at the Denny's.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
Like, he's they like, we'd walk in with our trees.
With their trees through the restaurant, have breakfast, yeah. And then work on their trees.
If you have a grand slam, I mean, you're ready to take on anything.
There's pretty much no bonsai that you can't handle.
We should bring that back.
Like, we could go right now.
Could you see Bisop showing up to a Denny's?
Well, Bisop would need like multiple Denny's would have to rent the whole space.
We'd take over the whole place.
Yeah. Americana right there. That's some serious Americana.
So our success, you know, beyond just learning how to grow and maintain things and kind of struggling with like, what soil do you use? And oh, let's try turfis and let's try pumice and let's try this blended soil that says bonsai soil from the nursery. And just kind of learning the, you know, the ins and outs and how those things don't really work the way you would expect or hope. And then when Mirai Life started, one of our other members, Josh Malonis, who's the vice president, he was like, I'm going to get on there. And we were like, yeah, we'll get on there too. So he actually joined before us. We were all pretty early in the Mirai Live group there. But, you know, just the information that you deliver is basically how we have been able to take things to a little bit higher success rate and another level of just quality and care and development of the trees and everything else. And then we came to visit. Darlene and I came to visit one time. The first time we came, you were in the workshop.
Yep,
working on.
I got a photo of us standing down in the shop together.
Yeah. So Lime was there, and of course your involvement with BSOP. We talked about like clubs and how that kind of works and doesn't work, and how to make that work better. And then we got on the waiting list to be students, and then you know.
And here we are.
And the rest is history.
And here we are. It's
in our matching sweaters.
And now we're matching zip up hoodies every day.
Yeah. just bonsai buddies now.
Yeah.
It's as sort of Mirai's student corps has expanded and stuff, it's been so amazing to get to work with students that are passionate and willing to sort of put in the time and experiment and roll the dice with failure in all of these regions across North America and the world, and to get to receive the feedback on what does work. I mean, Las Vegas is this sort of hinterland of a place to grow bonsai, but there's no reason that you can't grow bonsai there. It's just a matter of what is the system, what are the things we have to do, what are the nuances. You talked about timing in terms of when can we get away with work in that harsh environment and have the trees respond well. What soils do you need to use? How do you care for them? Shade cloth, wind breaks. I mean, it's the limitations that have existed in bonsai we are recognizing do not actually exist. It's just a matter of being dedicated enough to understand your environment.
Yeah. And that's a credit to you, I think, too, is we've talked about it a million times. Just like when we've had questions, you're like, have you tried this or that? And just, you know, it's a nice community to be a part of, and everybody's typically very positive. It's what we've noticed traveling around in Southern California, and then her brother now lives in Australia, so we visited him this past January and went to a few
other Mirai
folks. Yeah, Dave Siegel there and Boutique Bonsai there in Sydney, and hung out with him a couple times, and then Hugh Grant up the coast, and then we went to the National Collection in Canberra. And
yeah.
It's like bonsai people are just pretty cool. And I don't know if it's just if you have what it takes to try to keep another living thing alive, maybe you're just like decent in your core somehow.
Or, right.
You know, I don't know. Like we try to figure this out. Like, why are all the bonsai people like usually just cool?
You could look at it multiple ways, right? It's a selfless act because you put so much time and attention and care into caring for another living thing, but ultimately it is for selfish reasons because we think it's cool and it like satisfies us to some degree. You know, like
have to focus on the second part too?
I mean, you know, I can see it always. I could see people doing it always, but to a large degree, like that dedication to, and it's also not a living thing that's like ever going to talk back.
Sure.
You know, so yeah. You're not going to have that line of communication. It's such a more nuanced, subtle, like a softer relationship.
Oh, you're backbutting. You are happy with me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, look at you, you little devil, you.
You know? Go. Like,
oh, I see those roots growing.
Yeah.
I was just in the greenhouse this morning watering, and like I saw little white root tips out of the juniper rock planting we did for the stream.
Oh,
the nurturing material.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I was like, oh, hey, look at that. Like, doing real good, guys. You know, and like, even at this point, I mean, I started when I was 12. I'm 37, so it's 25 years in bonsai. You know, 6-year apprenticeship with Mr. Kimura. Yeah,
happy anniversary!
And I'm just exactly. And I'm just like, this is great. Look at those little root tips. Yeah. I'm still so captivated by it. But I do live not in like a negative way, but I do live vicariously through my students and the things that you guys are doing in these regions of North America. Like, I'm very proud. Like, it's very exciting to see people become passionate and like really experience the joy of bonsai, being able to in any way sort of assist in the success or offer ideas that encourage people to continue to invest time and effort into it. And then seeing students thrive is like one of the great pleasures of, and I didn't anticipate this being a part of Mirai, like teaching
the community.
Yeah. I had no idea. Right. I mean, teaching was a way to build people's confidence so that they could do bonsai. That was literally as far as I had gotten. Yeah. In the theory to teach, like, I'm gonna give people technique that way they can take care of these trees and somehow this is gonna work out. But what's formed is this beautiful sort of network of people that share a like-minded interest and approach to things, and it's just like that's become the richest part of it.
Sure. Without you, we wouldn't have met. I mean, we have an awesome class. I mean, granted, we're biased, but our juniper class is the best.
Yeah. Yeah,
obviously the best class that's ever existed in Mirai.
Shout out to Edwin and Klumner and Shelley. Yeah, I mean, and they're our backup support system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so we have a group text messages thread, so we're always chatting.
Because when things
talking.
Are going wrong, I mean, obviously we can't be texting Ryan Neal.
Ryan, are you available? Oh, no, you have 1,000 other students.
I mean, I try. You know,
you are good, actually. You are very good.
It can be challenging.
But when you can help each other, that's huge.
Yeah.
And the community is so big now with Mirai Live. I mean, that's how we, when we were in Australia, that's how we connected with people. We're like, oh, you know, I'd message people on Instagram or something that I'd never spoken to and say, hey, my wife and I are going to be in Australia. We're students at Bonsai Mirai, which holds a lot of kind of street cred, as well it should.
Sure.
And they, you know, you can come by and check out my collection, and that's awesome. And people just made time for us. I mean, we had a busy schedule, her brother and hanging out with her nieces and stuff, running around, but like we just squeezed in stuff and people just found time for us to come by and host us and, you know, offered us rides, pick us up from the train station. Like, people were just so, so cool. And all we said was, hey, we're Bonsai Mirai students. It'd be great to be able to, you know, connect and see your trees or something. They were happy to host you.
Just pretty very neat. Cool. Very
super cool.
Yeah. You need like Mirai luggage tags and Mirai things so that everybody knows who you are.
Yeah.
I was in the 7-Eleven.
Oh, he's wearing the hoodie. Okay.
That's what we got. Yeah.
I was in the 7-Eleven outside of Portland, picking up like a bag of peanuts because I hadn't had lunch, and I was shuttling Taff to and fro. And this guy walks in and he's like, "You're Ryan Neal," and I was like,
"Oh my gosh!"
And he's like, "You're the bonsai guy. I watch you on," and this is not somebody I met through BSOP or anything. And I was just like, oh, okay. And he's like, hey, man, nice to meet you. Cool. Love what you're doing. And it was just like, all right.
Yeah, rock star status. Oh, well, yeah,
you know, like 7-Eleven bag of peanuts meeting. But like, it was just like, oh, cool.
It's a
man.
Very random place.
He's like, I'd love to take care of your peanut purchase.
Right.
As a
grab that bag of peanuts for you. You want anything else?
Yeah.
Shoot, we were rocking our Mirai shirts the last time we were volunteering at Huntington. Or not the last time, one of the first times. And this old guy.
Oh, yeah.
What was his name? Richard? He's like,
his name's Richard.
Super Tuesday.
He's like, Super Tuesday. You know, Yeah, this is like a year and a half ago. We were volunteering with Ted at the Huntington.
Nice.
And this guy is like well into his 70s and doesn't like get around that well, but he's just super passionate, happy guy. And he saw the Mariah gear and he's like, are you guys... And then he just was like, Super Tuesday! And they, like, started losing it. Like, obviously, we speak the same language, you know?
Vegas!
Oh, yeah, Vegas! Oh, gosh. Man. Yeah, the obligatory
there was,
Vegas.
There's a phrase. Maybe we got a shirt idea here.
Yeah.
Ryan with Super Tuesday on it.
Amen. I've got, yeah, we've got something sort of built to those specifications. We can just insert some different dialogue. There we go.
Ira's going to be releasing a t-shirt line pretty soon. Las Vegas Bone Size Society. T-shirt line. Yeah. I have to run real quick.